Garcia sank to the floor, his finger slipping from the button in despair. It was hopeless. They were all dead men. 60. Smithback gripped the belt, playing a few more inches back toward the group. If anything, he thought, the water was rising even faster than before. There were surges every few minutes now, and although the current didn't seem to be getting stronger, the roar at the end of the tunnel had grown deafening. The oldest, the weakest, and the poorest swimmers were directly behind Smithback, clutching to the rope of belts. Behind them, the others were clinging together, treading water desperately. Everyone was silent now. There was no energy left to weep, moan, or even speak. Smithback looked up. 2 more feet, and he'd be able to grab the ladder.
"Must be a mother of a storm out there," said DeGusta.
He was next to Smithback, supporting an older woman.
"Sure rained on the museum's party,"
he added with a weak laugh. Smithback merely looked up, snapping on the light. 18 more inches.
"Smithback, quit switching the light on and off, all right? I'll tell you when to check."
Smithback felt another surge, which buffeted him against the brick walls of the tunnel. There were some gasps among the group, but no one cut loose. If the belt rope gave way, they'd all be drowned in 30 seconds. Smithback tried not to think about it. In a shaky but determined voice, the mayor started telling a story to the group. It involved several well-known people in City Hall. Smithback, despite scenting a scoop, felt sleepier and sleepier, a sign, he remembered, of hypothermia.
"Okay, Smithback, check the ladder."
The gruff voice of DeGusta jerked him awake. He shined the light upward, rattling it into life. In the past 15 minutes, the water had risen another foot, bringing the end of the ladder almost within reach. With a croak of delight, Smithback played more of the rope of belts back to the group.
"Here's what we're gonna do. You're gonna go up first. I'll help from down here, then I'll follow last, okay?"
"Okay,"
Smithback said, shaking himself into consciousness. DeGusta pulled the belt taut, then grabbed Smithback by the waistband and heaved him upward. Smithback reached over his head, grabbing the lowest rung with his free hand.
"Give me the light."
Smithback handed it down, then grabbed the rung with the other hand. He pulled himself up a little, then fell back, the muscles in his arms and back jerking spasmodically. With a deep breath, he pulled himself up again, this time reaching the second rung.
"Now you, grab the rung,"
DeGusta said to someone. Smithback leaned against the rungs, gasping for breath. Then, looking upward again, grasped the third rung, then the fourth. He felt around lightly with his feet to secure them on the first rung.
"Don't step on anyone's hands,"
DeGusta warned from below. He felt a hand guide his foot, and he was able to put his weight on the lowest rung. The firmness felt like heaven. He reached down with one hand and helped an elderly woman with salt-and-pepper hair. Then he turned back, feeling his strength returning, and moved upward. The ladder ended at the mouth of a large pipe jutting out horizontally, at the point where the curved vault of the roof met the tunnel wall. Gingerly, he moved to the pipe and began crawling into the darkness. Immediately, a putrid odor assaulted his nostrils.
"Sewer," he thought.
He stopped involuntarily for a moment, then moved forward again. The pipe ended, opening into blackness. Gingerly, he brought his feet outward and downward. A hard, firm, dirt floor met his shoes a foot or so beneath the mouth of the pipe. He could hardly believe their luck. A chamber of unknown size hung suspended here between the basement and the sub-basement. Probably some architectural palimpsest, a long-forgotten byproduct of one of the museum's many reconstructions. He clambered out and moved a few inches forward, then another few inches, sweeping his feet over the blackness of the floor. The stench around him was abominable. But it was not the smell of the beast, and for that he was profoundly grateful. Dry things, twigs, crunched beneath his feet. Behind him, he could hear grunting and the sound of others moving down the pipe toward him. The feeble light from DeGusta's flashlight in the sub-basement beyond could not penetrate the blackness. He turned around, knelt down by the mouth of the pipe, and began helping the bedraggled group out, directing them off to the side, warning them not to stray too far into the dark. One at a time, people emerged and spread out against the wall, feeling their way gingerly, collapsing in exhaustion. The room was quiet except for the sound of ragged breathing. Finally, Smithback heard the voice of DeGusta coming through the pipe.
"Christ, what is that reek? That damn flashlight finally gave out, so I dropped it into the water. Okay, people," he said in a louder voice, standing up. "I want you to count off."
The sound of dripping water started Smithback's heart racing until he realized it was simply DeGusta wringing out his sodden jacket. One by one, in tired voices, the group gave their names.
"Good. Now to figure out where we are. We may need to look for higher ground in case the water continues to rise."
"I'd like to look for higher ground anyway,"
came a voice from the darkness.
"It stinks in here something awful."
"It'll be tough without light. We'll need to go single file."
"I've got a lighter. Shall I see if it still works?"
"Careful. It smells like methane, if you ask me."
Smithback winced as a wavering yellow flame illuminated the chamber.
"Oh, Jesus!"
somebody screamed. The chamber was suddenly plunged into darkness again as the hand holding the lighter involuntarily jerked away. But not before Smithback got a single, devastating image of what lay around him. Margot strained ahead in the dimness, slowly moving the flashlight around the hall, trying to keep from deliberately spotlighting the beast as it crouched at the corner, observing them.
"Not yet," Pendergast murmured. "Wait until it shows itself fully."
The creature seemed to pause for an eternity, unmoving, as silent and motionless as a stone gargoyle. Margot could see small red eyes watching her in the gloom. Every now and then the eyes disappeared, then reappeared, as the creature blinked. The creature took another step, then froze again, as if making up its mind, its low, powerful frame tensed and ready. He who walks on all fours. Then it started forward, coming down the hall toward them with a strange, terrifying lope.
"Now!"
cried Pendergast. Margot reached up and fumbled for the miner's helmet, and the hall was suddenly bathed in light. Almost immediately she heard a deafening whang as Pendergast's powerful handgun barked next to her. The creature stopped briefly, and Margot could see it squinting, shaking its head against the light. It bent back as if to bite its haunch where the bullet had passed. Margot felt her mind receding from the reality. The low, pale head, horribly elongated, the crease of Pendergast's bullet, a white stripe above the eyes, the powerful forequarters, covered with dense fur and ending in long, rending talons, the lower rear haunches, wrinkled skin descending to five clawed toes. Its fur was matted with crusted blood, and fresh blood shone on the scales of its hindquarters. Whang! The creature's right foreleg was yanked behind it, and Margot heard a terrible roar of rage. It spun back to face them and sprang forward, ropes of saliva swinging madly from its jaws. Whang! Went the gun. A miss! And the creature kept coming, accelerating with horrible deliberation. Whang! She saw, as if in slow motion, the left hind leg jerk back and the creature falter slightly. But it recovered, and with a renewed howl, coarse hair bristling high in its haunches, it came for them again. Whang! Went the gun, but the creature did not slow, and at that point Margot realized with great clarity that their plan had failed, that there was time for only one more shot, and that the creature's charge could not be stopped. "Pendergast!" she cried, stumbling backward, her miner's light tilting crazily upward, scrambling away from the red eyes that stared straight into her own with a terrifyingly comprehensible blend of rage, lust, and triumph. Garcia sat on the floor, ears straining, wondering if the voice he'd heard was real, if there was somebody else out there, trapped in his nightmare, or whether it had just been a trick of his overheated brain. Suddenly, a very different sound boomed outside the door. Then there was another, and another. He scrambled to his feet. It couldn't be true. He fumbled with the radio. "Do you hear that?" a voice behind him said. Then the sound came again, twice. Then a short silence. Then again.
I swear to God, somebody's shooting in the hall,
Garcia cried. There was a long, dreadful silence.
It stopped, said Garcia in a whisper.
Did they get it? Did they get it?
Waters whimpered. The silence stretched on. Garcia clutched on the shotgun, its pump and trigger guard slick from sweat. 5 or 6 shots, that's all he'd heard. And the creature had killed a heavily armed SWAT team.
Did they get it?
Waters asked again.
Garcia listened intently but could hear nothing from the hall. This was the worst of all, the brief raising and sudden dashing of his hopes. He waited.
There was a rattling at the door.
No, whispered Garcia. It's back.
61.
Hand me that lighter,
DeGusta barked. Smithback, falling blindly backwards, saw the sudden spark of the flint and instinctively covered his eyes.
Oh, Christ,
he heard DeGusta groan. Then Smithback jerked as he felt something clutch his shoulder and drag him to his feet.
Listen, Smithback, you can't crap out of me now. I need you to help me keep these people together.
Smithback gagged as he forced his eyes open. The dirt floor ahead of him was awash in bones. Small, large, some broken and brittle, others with gristle still clinging to their knobby ends.
Not twigs,
Smithback said over and over again under his breath.
No, no, not twigs.
The light flicked out again, DeGusta conserving its flame. Another yellow flash, and Smithback looked wildly around. What he had kicked aside was the remains of a dog, a terrier by the looks of it. Glassy, staring eyes, light fur, small brown teats descending in ordered rows to the torn-out belly. Scattered around the floor were other carcasses, cats, rats, other creatures too thoroughly mauled or too long dead to be recognizable. Behind him, someone was screaming relentlessly. The light went out, then reappeared, farther ahead now as DeGusta moved forward.
Smithback, come with me. Everybody stare straight ahead. Let's go.
As Smithback slowly placed one foot in front of the other, looking down just enough to avoid stepping on the loathsomeness beneath, something registered in his peripheral vision. He turned his head toward the wall to his right. A pipe or duct had once run along the wall at shoulder height, but it had long since collapsed, its remains lying broken on the floor, half buried and awful. The heavy metal supports for the ductwork remained bolted to the wall, projecting outward like tines. Hung on the supports were a variety of human corpses, their forms seeming to waver in the dull glow of the flame. Smithback saw, but did not immediately comprehend, that all of the corpses had been decapitated. Scattered on the floor along the wall beneath were small, ruined objects that he knew must be heads. The bodies farthest from him had hung there the longest. They seemed more skeleton than flesh. He turned away, but not before his brain processed the final horror. On the meaty wrist of the nearest corpse was an unusual watch in the shape of a sundial. Moriarty's watch.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Smithbeck repeated over and over.
Poor George. You knew that guy? Shit, this thing gets hot.
The lighter flicked out again, and Smithback immediately stopped moving.
What kind of place is this?
Somebody behind them cried.
I haven't the faintest. I do. It's a larder.
The light came back on, and he started forward again, more quickly now. Behind him, Smithback could hear the mayor urging the people to keep moving in a dead, mechanical voice. Suddenly, the light flicked out again, and the journalist froze in position.
We're at the far wall,
he heard DeGusta say in the darkness.
One of the passages here slopes down, the other slopes up. We're taking the high road.
DeGusta flicked on the lighter again and continued forward, Smithback following. After several moments, the smell began to dissipate. The ground grew damp and soft beneath his feet. Smithback felt, or imagined he felt, the faintest hint of a cool breeze on his cheek. DeGusta laughed.
Christ, that feels fine.
The tunnel grew damp underfoot, then ended abruptly in another ladder. DeGusta stepped towards it, reaching up with the lighter. Smithback moved forward eagerly, sniffing the freshening breeze. There was a sudden rushing sound, and then a thud, thud above, and a bright light passed quickly over them, followed by a splash of viscous water.
A manhole! We made it! I can't believe it! We fucking made it!
He scrambled up the ladder and heaved against the round plate.
It's fastened down. 20 men couldn't lift this. Help!
He started calling, clambering up the ladder and placing his mouth close to one of the pry holes.
Somebody help us, for Christ's sake!
And then he started to laugh, sinking against the metal ladder and dropping the lighter. Then Smithback also collapsed to the floor of the passage, laughing, crying, unable to control himself.
We made it! Smithback, we made it! Kiss me, Smithback, you fucking journalist! I love you, and I hope you make a million on this!
Smithback heard a voice above them from the street.
You hear somebody yelling?
Hey, you up there, want to earn a reward?
Hear that? There is somebody down there. You!
Did you hear me? Get us out of here!
How much?
Another voice said.
$20. Call the fire department. Get us out.
$50, man, and we walk.
DeGusta couldn't stop laughing.
$50, then. Now get us the hell out of here.
He turned around and spread his arms.
Smithback, move everybody forward. Folks, Mayor Harper, welcome back to New York City.
The door rattled once more. Garcia pressed the buttstock tight against his cheek, crying quietly. It was trying to get in again. He took a deep breath and tried to steady the shotgun. Then he realized that the rattling had resolved itself into a knock. It sounded again, louder, and Garcia heard a muffled voice.
Is anyone in there?
Who is it?
Garcia answered thickly.
Special Agent Pendergast, FBI, New Orleans office.
Garcia could hardly believe it. As he opened the door, he saw a tall, thin man looking placidly back at him, his pale hair and eyes ghostly in the dim hallway. He held a flashlight in one hand and a large pistol in the other. Blood trailed down one side of his face, and his shirt was soaked in crazy Rorschach patterns. A shortish young woman with mousy brown hair stood beside him, a yellow miner's lamp dwarfing her head, her face, hair, and sweater covered with more dark, wet stains. Pendergast finally broke into a grin.
We did it, he said simply.
Only Pendergast's grin made Garcia realize that the blood covering the two was not their own.
How?
He faltered. They pushed their way past him as the others, lined up under the dark museum schematic, stared, frozen by fear and disbelief. Pendergast indicated a chair with the flashlight.
Have a seat, Miss Green, he said.
Thank you, said Margot, the miner's light on her forehead bobbing upward. Such a gentleman. Pendergast seated himself.
Does anyone have a handkerchief?
He asked. Alan came forward, pulling one from his pocket. Pendergast handed it to Margot, who wiped the blood from her face and handed it back. Pendergast carefully wiped his face and hands.
Much obliged, Mr. Allen. Tom Allen. Mr. Allen.
Pendergast handed the blood-soaked handkerchief to Allen, who started to return it to his pocket, froze, then dropped it quickly. He stared at Pendergast.
Is it dead? Yes, Mr. Allen, it's quite dead.
You killed it?
We killed it. Rather, Ms. Green here killed it.
Call me Margot. And it was Mr. Pendergast who fired the shot. Ah, but Margot, you told me where to place the shot. I never would have thought of it. All big game, lion, water buffalo, elephant, have eyes on the sides of their head. If they're charging, you'd never consider the eye. It's just not a viable shot.
But the creature, Margot explained to Alan, had a primate's face. Eyes rotated to the front for stereoscopic vision, a direct path to the brain. And with that incredibly thick skull, once you put a bullet inside the brain, it would simply bounce around until it was spent.
You killed the creature with a shot through the eye? Garcia asked incredulously.
I'd hit it several times, Pendergast said. But it was simply too strong and too angry. I haven't had a good look at the creature. I think I'll leave that until much later. But it's safe to say that no other shot could have stopped it in time.
Pendergast adjusted his tie knot with two slender fingers. Unusually fastidious, Margot thought, considering the blood and bits of gray matter covering his white shirt. She would never forget the sight of the creature's brain exploding out of the ruined eye socket, at once a horrifying and beautiful sight. In fact, it was the eyes, the horrible, angry eyes, that had given her a sudden, desperate flash of an idea, even as she'd scrambled backward, away from the rotting stench and slaughterhouse breath. Suddenly, she was clutching her sides, shivering. In a moment, Pendergast had motioned to Garcia to give up his uniform jacket. He draped it over her shoulders.
"Calm down, Margot," he said, kneeling at her side. "It's all over."
"We've got to get Dr. Frock,"
she stammered through blue lips.
"In a minute, Pendergast said soothingly.
"Shall we make a report?" Garcia asked. "This radio is just about enough juice left for one more broadcast."
"Yes, and we have to send a relief party for Lieutenant DeGusta," Pendergast said. Then he frowned. "I suppose this means talking to Coffee."
"I don't think so," Garcia said. "Apparently there's been a change of command."
Pendergast's eyebrows raised.
"Indeed?"
"Indeed."
Garcia handed the radio to Pendergast. "An agent named Slade is claiming to be in charge. Why don't you do the honors?"
"If you wish," Pendergast said.
"I'm glad it's not Special Agent Coffee. Had it been, I'm afraid I would have taken him to task. I respond sharply to insults." He shook his head. "It's a very bad habit, but one I find hard to break."
62. 4 weeks later. When Margot arrived, Pendergast and DeGusta were already in Frock's office. Pendergast was examining something on a low table while Frock talked animatedly next to him. DeGusta was walking restlessly around the office, looking bored, picking things up and putting them down again. The latex cast of the claw sat in the middle of Frock's desk like a nightmare paperweight. A large cake, purchased by Frock in celebration of Pendergast's imminent departure, sat in the middle of the warm, sunlit room, the white icing already beginning to droop.
"Last time I was there, I had a crayfish gumbo that was truly magnificent," Frock was saying, gripping Pendergast's elbow. "Ah, Margot," he said, wheeling around. "Come in and take a look."
Margot crossed the room. Spring had finally taken hold of the city, and through the great bow windows, she could see the blue expanse of the Hudson River flowing southward, sparkling in the sunlight. On the promenade below, joggers filed past in steady ranks. A large mold of the creature's feet lay on the low table, next to the Cretaceous plaque of fossil footprints. Frock traced the tracks lovingly.
"If not the same family, certainly the same order," he said. "And the creature did indeed have five toes on the hind feet, yet another link to the Mbun figurine."
Margot, looking closely, thought the two didn't seem all that similar.
"Fractal evolution?" she suggested.
Frock looked at her.
"It's possible, but it would take cladistic analysis to know for sure."
He grimaced.
"Of course, that won't be possible now that the government has whisked the remains away for God only knows what purpose."
In the months since the opening night disaster, public sentiment had gone from shock and incredulity to fascination to ultimate acceptance. For the first 2 weeks, the press had been abuzz with stories of the beast, but the conflicting accounts of the survivors created confusion and uncertainty. The only item that could settle the controversy, the corpse,
was immediately removed from the scene in a large white van with government plates, never to be seen again. Even Pendergast claimed to be ignorant of its whereabouts. Publicity soon turned to the human cost of the disaster, and to the lawsuits that threatened the manufacturers of the security system, and, to a lesser degree, the police department and the museum itself. Time magazine had run a lead story entitled, "How Safe Are Our National Institutions?" Now, weeks later, people had begun to view the creature as a one-of-a-kind phenomenon. A freak throwback, like the dinosaur fishes that occasionally showed up in the nets of deep-sea fishermen. Interest had started to wane. The opening night survivors were no longer interviewed on talk shows, the projected Saturday morning cartoon series had been canceled, and Museum Beast action figures were going unsold in toy stores. Frock glanced around.
"Forgive my lack of hospitality. Sherry, anyone?"
There were murmurs of "no thanks."
"Not unless you've got a 7-Up chaser,"
DeGusta said. Pendergast blanched and looked in his direction. DeGusta took the latex cast of the claw from Frock's desk and held it up.
"Nasty," he said.
"Exceptionally nasty," Frock agreed. "It truly was part reptile, part primate. I won't go into the technical details. I'll leave that to Gregory Kawakita, who I've put to work analyzing what data we do have. But it appears that the reptilian genes are what gave the creature its strength, speed, and muscle mass. The primate genes contributed the intelligence and possibly made it endothermic, warm-blooded. A formidable combination."
"Yeah, sure,"
DeGusta said, laying the cast down.
"But what the hell was it?"
Frock chuckled.
"My dear fellow, we simply don't have enough data yet to say exactly what it was. And since it appears to have been the last of its kind, we may never know. We've just received an official survey of the Tapui this creature came from. The devastation there has been complete. The plant this creature lived on, which, by the way, we have posthumously named Lilliciae imbuenensis, appears to be totally extinct. Mining has poisoned the entire swamp surrounding the Tapui, not to mention the fact that the entire area was initially torched with napalm to help clear the area for mining. There were no traces of any other similar creatures wandering about the forest anywhere. While I am normally horrified by such environmental destruction, in this case it appears to have rid the earth of a terrible menace." He sighed. "As a safety precaution, and against my advice, I might add, the FBI has destroyed all the packing fibers and plant specimens here in the museum. So the plant, too, is truly extinct."
"How do we know it was the last of its kind?" Margot asked. "Couldn't there be another somewhere?"
"Not likely," said Frock. "That Tapui was an ecological island. By all accounts, a unique place in which animals and plants had developed a singular interdependence over literally millions of years."
"And there certainly aren't any more creatures in the museum," Pendergast said, coming forward. "With those ancient blueprints I found at the Historical Society, we were able to section off the sub-basement and comb every square inch. We found many things of interest to urban archaeologists, but no further sign of the creature."
"It looked so sad in death," Margot said. "So lonely. I almost feel sorry for it."
"It was lonely," said Frock. "Lonely and lost. Traveling 4,000 miles from its jungle home, following the trail of the last remaining specimens of the precious plants that kept it alive and free from pain. But it was very evil and very fierce. I saw at least 12 bullet holes in the carcass before they took it away."
The door opened and Smithback walked in, theatrically waving a manila envelope in one hand and a magnum of champagne in the other. He whipped a sheaf of papers out of the envelope, holding them skyward with one long arm.
"A book contract, folks," he said, grinning.
DeGusta scowled and turned away, picking up the claw again.
"I got everything I wanted and made my agent rich," Smithback crowed.
"And yourself rich, too,"
said DeGusta, looking as if he'd like to use the claw on the writer. Smithback cleared his throat dramatically.
"I've decided to donate half the royalties to a fund set up in the memory of Officer John Bailey to benefit his family."
DeGusta turned toward Smithback.
"Get lost," he said.
"No, really," said Smithback. "Half the royalties. After the advance is earned out, of course," he added hastily.
D'Gusta started to step toward Smith back, then stopped abruptly.
"You got my cooperation,"
he said in a low voice, his jaw working stiffly. "Thanks, Lieutenant. I think I'll need it."
"That's Captain as of yesterday," said Pendergast.
"Captain D'Gusta?"
Margot asked.
"You've been promoted?"
D'Gusta nodded. "Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, the chief tells me."
He pointed a finger at Smithback.
"I get to read what you say about me before it goes to press, Smithback."
"Now, wait a minute," Smithback said. "There are certain ethics that journalists have to follow."
"Balls!"
D'Gusta exploded. Margot turned to Pendergast. "I can see this will be an exciting collaboration," she whispered. Pendergast nodded. There was a light rapping, and the head of Greg Kawakita appeared from around the door to the outer office. "Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Frock," he said. "Your secretary didn't tell me you were busy. We can go over the results later."
"Nonsense!" cried Frock. "Come in, Gregory. Mr. Pendergast, Captain D'Gusta, this is Gregory Kawakita. He's the author of the GSE, the extrapolation program that allowed us to come up with such an accurate profile of the creature."
"You have my gratitude," Pendergast said. "Without that program, none of us would have been here today."
"Thanks very much, but the program is really Dr. Frock's brainchild," Kawakita said, eyeing the cake. "I just put the pieces together. Besides, there were a lot of things the extrapolator didn't tell you. The forward placement of the eyes, for instance."
"Why, Greg, success has made you humble," Smithback said. "In any case," he continued, turning to Pendergast, "I've got a few questions for you. This vintage champagne doesn't come free, you know."
He fixed the FBI agent with an expectant gaze.
"Whose bodies did we discover in the lair, anyway?"
Pendergast raised his shoulders in a slight shrug.
"I guess there's no harm in telling you, although this is not for publication until you receive official word. As it happens, 5 of the 8 remains have been identified. 2 were those of homeless street persons who crept into the old basement, presumably looking for warmth on a winter's night. Another was that of a foreign tourist we found on Interpol's missing persons list. Another, as you know, was George Moriarty, the assistant curator under Ian Cuthbert."
"Poor George," Margot whispered. For weeks she had avoided thinking about Moriarty's last moments, his final struggle with the beast. To die that way, and to be hung up like a side of beef. Pendergast waited a moment before continuing.
"The 5th body has been tentatively identified from dental records as a man named Montague, an employee of the museum who vanished several years ago."
"Montague," Frock said. "So the story was true."
"Yes," said Pendergast. "It seems that certain members of the museum administration, Wright, Rickman, Cuthbert, and perhaps Ippolito, suspected there was something prowling in the museum. When a vast quantity of blood was found in the old basement, they had it washed away without notifying the police. When Montague's disappearance coincided with that discovery, the group did nothing to shed any light on the event. They also had reason to believe that the creature was somehow connected to the Whittlesea expedition. Those suspicions may have been behind the moving of the crates. In retrospect, it was a terribly unwise move. It was what precipitated the killings."
"You're right, of course,"
Frock said, wheeling himself back toward his desk.
"We know the creature was highly intelligent. It realized it would be in danger if its existence in the museum was discovered. I think it must have curbed its normally fierce nature as a means of self-preservation. When it first reached the museum, it was desperate, perhaps feral, and it killed Montague when it saw him with the artifacts and the plants. But after that, it grew quickly cautious. It knew where the crates were, and it had a supply of the plant, or at least it would until the packing material gave out. It was parsimonious in its consumption. Of course, the hormones in the plant were highly concentrated, and the beast supplemented its diet occasionally, in stealthy ways. Rats living in the sub-basement, cats escaped from the animal behavior department, once or twice even luckless human beings that wandered too deep into the museum's secret places. But it was always careful to conceal its kills, and several years passed in which it remained, for the most part, undetected."
He shifted slightly, the wheelchair creaking.
"Then it happened. The crates were removed, put under lock and key in the secure area. The beast grew first hungry, then desperate. Perhaps it grew murderous with rage at the beings who had deprived it of the plants, beings who themselves could be a substitute, though poor, for that which they'd taken away. The frenzy grew, and the beast killed, then killed again.
Frock withdrew his handkerchief and wiped his forehead.
But it didn't lose all rationality, he continued. Remember how it hid the body of the policeman in the exhibition? Even though its bloodlust had been aroused, even though it was mad with desire for the plants, it had the presence of mind to realize that the killings were attracting unwanted attention to itself. Perhaps it had planned on bringing the body of Beauregard back down to its lair. Chances are, it was unable to do so. The exhibition was far beyond its usual haunts, so it hid the body instead. After all, the hypothalamus was its primary objective. The rest was just meat.
Margot shuddered. I've wondered more than once just why the beast went into that exhibition, Pendergast said. Frock raised his index finger.
So have I, and I think I know the reason. Remember, Mr. Pendergast, what else was in the exhibition?
Pendergast nodded slowly.
Of course.
The figurine of Umbun.
Exactly, said Frock. The figurine depicting the beast itself. The creature's one link with its home, the home that it had lost utterly.
You seem to have it all figured out, Smithback said. But if Wright and Cuthbert were aware of this thing, how did they know it was connected with the Whittlesea expedition?
I believe I can answer that, Pendergast said. They knew, of course, why the ship carrying the crates from Belém to New Orleans was delayed so long, much the way you learned, I expect, Mr. Smithback. Smithback suddenly looked nervous.
Well, he began,
They also read Whittlesey's journal, and they knew the legends as well as anybody. Then, when Montague, the person assigned to curating the crates, disappeared, and a pool of blood was discovered near the location of the crates, it didn't take a savant to put everything together. And besides, he said, his expression clouding, Cuthbert more or less confirmed it for me. As well as he was able, of course.
Frock nodded. They paid a terrible price. Winston and Lavinia dead. Ian Cuthbert institutionalized. It's distressing beyond words.
True, Kawakita said. But it's no secret that it's made you top contender for the next director of the museum.
He would think of that, Margot thought. Frock shook his head. I doubt if it will be offered me, Gregory. Once the dust settles, rational heads will prevail. I'm too controversial. Besides, the directorship doesn't interest me. I have too much new material here for me to delay my next book any longer.
One thing that Dr. Wright and the rest didn't know, Pendergast went on, in fact, something that nobody here knows, is that the killings didn't start in New Orleans. There was a very similar murder in Belém, in the warehouse where the crates had been housed while awaiting shipping. I learned about it when I was investigating the shipboard killings.
That must have been the creature's first stop on the way to New York, Smithback said. I guess it brings the story full circle.
He guided Pendergast to the sofa.
Now, Mr. Pendergast, I suppose this also solves the mystery of what happened to Whittlesey.
The creature killed him. That seems fairly certain, said Pendergast.
Say, you don't mind if I get a piece of that cake? Smithback placed a restraining hand on his arm.
How do you know?
That it killed Whittlesey?
We found a souvenir in its lair.
You did?
Smithback whipped out his microcassette recorder.
Put that back in your pocket, if you please, Mr. Smithback.
Yes, it was something Whittlesey wore around his neck, apparently. A medallion in the shape of a double arrow.
That was embossed on his journal, Smithback said.
And on the letterhead of the note he sent Montague, Margot chimed in.
Apparently it was Whittlesey's family crest. We found it in the lair, a piece of it anyway. Why the beast carried it from the Amazon, we'll never know, but there it is.
We found other artifacts in there, too, said
DeGusta through a mouthful of cake.
The thing was a regular collector.
Like what? Margot asked, walking toward one of the bow windows and gazing out at the landscape beyond.
Things you wouldn't expect. A set of car keys, a lot of coins and subway tokens, even a beautiful gold pocket watch. We looked up the guy whose name was inscribed inside the watch, and he told us he'd lost it 3 years ago. He'd visited the museum and been pickpocketed, DeGusta shrugged. Maybe that pickpocket is one of the unidentified bodies. Or maybe we'll never find him. The creature kept it hung by its chain from a nail in the wall of its lair, Pendergast said. It liked beautiful things. Another sign of intelligence, I suppose.
Was everything picked up from inside the museum? Asked Smithback.
As far as we can tell, Pendergast said. There's no evidence the creature could or wanted to obtain egress from the museum.
No,
Smithback said.
Then what about the exit you were leading DeGusta toward?
He found it, Pendergast said simply. You were all very lucky.
Smithback turned to ask DeGusta another question, and Pendergast took the opportunity to get up and head for the cake.
It was awfully nice of you to throw me this party, Dr. Frock, he said as he returned.
You saved our lives, Frock said.
I thought a little cake might be in order as our way of wishing you bon voyage. I'm afraid, then, Pendergast continued, that I may be at this party under false pretenses.
Why is that?
Frock asked. I may not be leaving New York permanently. The directorship of the New York office is up for reassignment, you see.
You mean it's not going to coffee?
Smithback smirked. Pendergast shook his head.
Poor Mr. Coffee, he said.
I hope he enjoys his position in the Waco field office. In any case, the mayor, who has become a great fan of Captain DeGusta here, seems to think I have a good shot at it.
Well, congratulations,
cried Frock. It isn't certain yet, Pendergast said, nor am I certain I care to remain up here. Although the place does have its charms.
He got up and walked to the bow window, where Margot was standing, staring out at the Hudson River and the green hills of the Palisades beyond.
What are your plans, Margot? He asked.
She turned to face him. I've decided to stay at the museum until I've finished my dissertation. Frock laughed.
The truth is, I refuse to let her go, he said.
Margot smiled. Actually, I've received an offer from Columbia. Tenure track assistant professorship starting next year. Columbia was my father's alma mater, so I've got to finish it, you see.
Great news, said Smithback. We'll have to celebrate over dinner tonight.
Dinner tonight?
Café des Artistes, 7 o'clock, he said. Listen, you've got to come. I'm a world-famous author, or about to become one. This champagne's getting warm, he continued, reaching for the bottle.
Everyone crowded round as Frock brought out glasses. Smithback angled the bottle toward the ceiling and fired off the cork with a satisfying pop.
What'll we drink to?
Asked DeGusta as the glasses were filled.
To my book, said Smithback.
To Special Agent Pendergast and a safe journey home, Frock said.
To the memory of George Moriarty, Margot said quietly. To George Moriarty. There was a silence.
God bless us, everyone, Smithback intoned.
Margot punched him playfully. Epilogue 63 Long Island City, 6 months later. The rabbit jerked as the needle sank into its haunch. Kawakita watched as the dark blood filled up the syringe. He placed the rabbit carefully back in its hutch, then transferred the blood to 3 centrifugal test tubes. He opened the nearby centrifuge, slotted the tubes into the drum, and shut the lid. Flicking the switch, he listened to the hum slowly build to a whine as the force of the rotation separated the blood into its components. He sat back in the wooden chair and let his eyes roam around the surroundings. The office was dusty and the lighting dim, but Kawakita preferred it that way. No sense in drawing attention to oneself. It had been very difficult in the beginning, finding the right place, assembling the equipment, even paying the rent. It was unbelievable how much they wanted for run-down warehouses in Queens. The computer had been the hardest item to come by. Instead of buying one, He had finally managed to hack his way over the telephone long lines into a large mainframe at the Solokov College of Medicine. It was a relatively secure site from which to run his genetic extrapolation program. He peered through the dingy window to the shop floor below. The large space was dark and relatively vacant, the only light coming from aquariums sitting on metal racks along the far wall. He could hear the faint bubbling of the filtration systems. The lights from the tanks cast a dim greenish glow across the floor. 2 dozen, give or take a few. Soon he'd need more. But money was becoming less and less of a problem. It was amazing, thought Kawakita, how the most elegant solutions were the simplest ones. Once you saw it, the answer was obvious. But it was seeing that answer for the first time that separated the timeless scientist from the merely great. The Mbun riddle was like that. He, Kawakita, had been the only one to suspect it, to see it, and now to prove it. The whine of the centrifuge began to decrease in pitch, and soon the completed light began blinking a slow, monotonous red. Kawakita got up, opened the lid, and removed the tubes. The rabbit blood had been divided into its 3 constituents, clear serum on top, a thin layer of white blood cells in the middle, and a heavy layer of red blood cells at the bottom. He carefully suctioned off the serum, then placed drops of the cells into a series of watch glasses. Finally, he added various reagents and enzymes. One of the watch glasses turned purple. Kawakita smiled. It had been so simple. After Frock and Margot had blundered up to him at the party, his initial skepticism had quickly changed to fascination. He had been on the periphery before, not really paying attention. But practically from the minute he'd hit Riverside Drive that evening, carried along in the stream of countless other hysterical guests who'd rushed from the opening, he began thinking. Then, in the aftermath, he began asking questions. When later he'd heard Frock pronounce the mystery solved, Kawakita's curiosity had only increased. Perhaps, to be fair, he'd had a little more objective distance than those who'd been inside the museum that night, fighting the beast in the dark. But whatever the reason, there seemed to be small defects with the solution. Little problems, minor contradictions that everyone had missed. Everyone except Kawakita. He'd always been a very cautious researcher. Cautious, yet full of insatiable curiosity. It had helped him in the past, at Oxford, and in his early days at the museum, and now it helped him again. His caution had made him build a keystroke capture routine into the extrapolator, for security reasons, of course, but also to learn what others might use his program for. So it was only natural that he'd go back and examine what Frock and Margot had done. All he'd had to do was press a few keys, and the program reeled off every question Frock and Margot had asked, every bit of data they had entered, and every result they had obtained. That data had pointed him toward the real solution to the Mbun mystery. It had been there under their noses the whole time, had they known what questions to ask. Kawakita learned to ask the right questions, and along with the answer came a stunning discovery. A soft knock sounded at the warehouse door. Kawakita walked down the stairs to the main floor of the warehouse, moving without sound or hesitation through the gloom.
"Who is it?"
he whispered, his voice hoarse.
"Tony,"
said the voice. Kawakita effortlessly slid back the iron bar from the door and pulled it open. A figure stepped through.
"It's dark in here,"
the man said. He was small and wiry and walked with a distinct roll to his shoulders. He looked around nervously.
"Keep the lights off,"
said Kawakita sharply.
"Follow me."
They walked to the far end of the warehouse. There, a long table had been set up under dull infrared lamps. The table was covered with drying fibers. At the end of the table was a scale. Kawakita scooped up a small handful of fibers and weighed them, removing several, then dropping a few back on. Then he slid the fibers into a Ziploc bag. He looked at his visitor expectantly. The man dug his hand into his pants pocket and extended a wad of crumpled bills. Kawakita counted them. 5 20s. He nodded and handed over the small bag. The man grabbed it eagerly and began to tear open the seam.
"Not here,"
said Kawakita. "Sorry," the man said. He moved toward the door as quickly as the dim light would allow.
"Try larger amounts," Kawakita suggested. "Steep it in boiling water. That increases the concentration. I think you'll find the results very gratifying."
The man nodded.
"Gratifying," he said slowly, as if tasting the word. "I will have more for you on Tuesday," Kawakita said. "Thank you," the man whispered and left.
Kawakita closed the door and slid the bolt back in place. It had been a long day, and he felt bone-tired, but he was looking forward to nightfall, when the sounds of the city would subside, and darkness would cover the land. Night was rapidly becoming his favorite time of the day. Once he reconstructed what Frock and Margot had done with his program, everything else fell into place. All he'd needed was to find one of the fibers. But that proved a difficult task. The secure area had been painstakingly cleaned, and the crates had been emptied of their artifacts and burned, along with the packing material. The lab where Margot had done the initial work was now spotless, the plant press destroyed. But nobody had remembered to clean out Margot's handbag, which was notorious throughout the anthropology department for its untidiness. Margot herself had thrown it in the museum incinerator several days after the disaster as a precaution. But not before Kawakita had found the fiber he needed. Despite his other trials, the supreme challenge had been growing the plant from a single fiber. It had taxed all his abilities, his knowledge of botany and genetics. But he was channeling all his ferocious energies into one thing now. Thoughts of tenure vanished, a leave of absence taken from the museum. And he had finally achieved it, not 5 weeks earlier. He remembered the surge of triumph he felt when the little green node appeared on an agar-covered petri dish. And now he had a large and steady supply growing in the tanks, fully inoculated with the reovirus. The strange reovirus that dated back 65 million years. It had proven to be a perversely attractive type of lily pad, blooming almost continuously, big, deep purple blossoms with venous appendages and bright yellow stamens. The virus was concentrated in the tough fibrous stem. He was harvesting 2 pounds a week and poised to increase his yield exponentially.
"The Kathoga knew all about this plant," thought Kawakita.
What appeared to be a blessing turned out for them to be a curse. They had tried to control its power, but failed. The legend told it best. The devil failed to keep his bargain, and the child of the devil, the Mbun, had run wild. It had turned on its masters. It could not be controlled. But Kawakita would not fail. The rabbit serum tests proved that he would succeed. The final piece of the puzzle fell into place when he remembered what that cop, DeGusta, had mentioned at the going-away party for the FBI agent. That they had found a double-arrow pendant belonging to Julian Whittlesey in the creature's lair. Proof, they said, that the monster had killed Whittlesey.
Proof.
What a joke. Proof, rather, that the monster was Whittlesey. Kawakita remembered clearly the day everything came together for him. It was an apotheosis, a revelation. It explained everything. The creature, the museum beast, he who walks on all fours, was Whittlesey. And the proof lay within his grasp. His extrapolation program. Kawakita had placed human DNA on one side, and the real virus DNA on the other. And then he had asked for the intermediate form. The computer gave the creature, he who walks on all fours. The real virus in the plant was astonishing. Chances are, it had existed relatively unchanged since the Mesozoic era. In sufficient quantities, it had the power to induce morphological change of an astonishing nature. Everyone knew that the darkest, most isolated areas of rainforest held undiscovered plants of almost inconceivable importance to science. But Kawakita had already discovered his miracle. By eating the fibers and becoming infected with the reovirus, Whittlesey had turned into Mbun.
Umbun. The word the Kathoga used for the wonderful, terrible plant, and for the creatures those who ate it became. Kawakita could now visualize parts of the Kathoga's secret religion. The plants were a curse that was simultaneously hated and needed. The creatures kept the enemies of the Kathoga at bay, yet they themselves were a constant threat to their masters. Chances are, the Kathoga only kept one of the creatures around at a time. More than that would be too dangerous. The cult would have centered around the plant itself, its cultivation and harvesting. The climax of their ceremonials was undoubtedly the induction of a new creature, the force-feeding of the plant to the unwilling human victim. Initially, large quantities of the plant would be needed to ensure sufficient reovirus to affect the bodily change. Once the transformation was complete, the plant needed to be consumed only in small quantities, supplemented, of course, by other proteins. But it was critical that the dose be maintained. Otherwise, intense pain, even madness, would result as the body tried to revert. Of course, death would intervene before that happened. And the desperate creature would, if at all possible, find a substitute for the plant, the human hypothalamus being by far the most satisfactory. In the close, comforting darkness, listening to the tranquil humming of the Aquaria, Kawakita could guess at the drama that had played itself out in the jungle. The Kathoga, laying eyes on a white man for the first time. Whittlesey's accomplice, Crocker, had no doubt been found first, but he'd encountered the Kathoga's creature, not the Kathoga themselves. Perhaps the creature had been old or enfeebled. Perhaps Crocker had killed the creature with the expedition's gun as the creature disemboweled him. Or perhaps not. But when the Kathoga found Whittlesey, Kawakita knew there was only one possible outcome. He wondered what Whittlesey must have felt, bound, perhaps ceremonially, being force-fed the reovirus from the strange plant he himself had collected just days earlier. Perhaps they brewed him a liquor from the plant's leaves, or perhaps they simply forced him to eat the dried fibers. They must have attempted to do with this white man what they had failed to do with their own kind, create a monster they could control, a monster that would keep out the road builders and the prospectors and the miners that were poised to invade the Tapui from the south and destroy them, a monster that would terrorize the surrounding tribes without terrorizing its masters, that would ensure the security and isolation of the Kathoga forever. But then civilization came anyway, with all its terrors. Kawakita imagined the day it happened. The Whittlesey thing, crouched in the jungle, seeing the fire come falling from the sky, burning the Tapui, the Kathoga, the precious plants. He alone escaped. And he alone knew where the life-giving fibers could still be found after the jungle was destroyed. He knew, because he had sent them there. Or perhaps Whittlesey was already gone when the Tapui was burned. Perhaps the Kathoga had been unable to control once again the creature they had created. Maybe Whittlesey, in his pitiful, terrible condition, had set his own agenda, which hadn't included sticking around as the Kathoga's avenging angel. Perhaps he'd simply wanted to go home. So he had abandoned the Kathoga, and the Kathoga had been destroyed by progress. But for the most part, Kawakita was indifferent to the anthropological details. He was interested in the power inherent in the plant and the harnessing of such power. You needed to control the source before you could control the creature. And that, thought Kawakita, is exactly why I'm going to succeed where the Kathoga failed. He was controlling the source. Only he knew how to grow this difficult and delicate swamp lily from the depths of the Amazon jungle. Only he knew the proper pH of the water, the right temperature, the proper light, the correct mix of nutrients. Only he knew how to inoculate the plant with the reovirus. They would be dependent on him. And with the genetic splicing he had done through the rabbit serum, he'd been able to purify the essential strength of the virus, engineering it to be cleaner, while diminishing some of the more unpleasant side effects. At least, he was fairly sure he had. These were revolutionary discoveries. Everyone knew that viruses inserted their own DNA into the cells of their victim. Normally, that DNA would simply instruct the victim's cells to make more viruses.
That's what happened in every virus known to man, from the flu to AIDS. This virus was different. It inserted a whole array of genes into its victim. Reptile genes. Ancient reptile genes. 65-million-year-old genes. Found today in the lowly gecko and a few other species. And it had apparently borrowed primate genes, no doubt human genes, over time as well. A virus that stole genes from its host and incorporated those genes into its victims. Those genes, instead of making more viruses, remade the victim, reshaped the victim bit by bit into a monster. The viruses instructed the body's own machinery to change the bone structure, the endocrine system, the limbs and skin and hair and internal organs. It changed the behavior, the weight, speed, and cunning of the victim, gave the victim uncanny senses of smell and hearing, but diminished its eyesight and voice. Gave it immense power and bulk and speed, while leaving its wonderful hominid brain relatively intact. In short, the drug, the virus, turned a human victim into a terrible killing machine. No, the word victim did not fairly describe one infected with the virus. A better word might be symbiont, because it was a privilege to receive the virus, a gift. A gift from Greg Kawakita. It was beautiful. In fact, it was sublime. The possibilities for genetic engineering were endless, and already Kawakita had ideas for improvements. New genes the reovirus could insert into its host. Human genes as well as animal genes. He controlled what genes the reovirus would insert into its host. He controlled what the host would become. Unlike the primitive, superstitious Kothoga, he was in control through science. An interesting side effect of the plant was its narcotic effect, a wonderful, clean rush, without the unpleasant down of so many other drugs. Perhaps that was how the plant had originally ensured its own ingestion, and thus its propagation. But for Kawakita, this side effect had provided cash from which to finance his research. He hadn't wanted to sell the drug originally, but the financial pressures he'd experienced had made it inevitable. He smiled as he thought of how easy it had been. The drug had already been given a name by the select coterie of eager users. Glaze. The market was avid, and Kawakita could sell as much as he could make. Too bad it seemed to go so quickly. Night had fallen. Kawakita removed his dark glasses and inhaled the rich fragrance of the warehouse, the subtle odor of the fibers, the smell of water and dust and internal combustion from the ambient air, mingled with mold and sulfur dioxide and a multitude of other smells. His chronic allergies had all but vanished. "Must be the clean Long Island air," he thought wryly. He removed his tight shoes and curled his toes with pleasure. He had made the most stunning advancement in genetics since the discovery of the double helix. It would have won him a Nobel Prize, he thought with an ironic smile. Had he chosen that route? But who needed a Nobel Prize when the whole world was suddenly there for the plucking? There came another knock at the door.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Relic by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Copyright 1994 by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Read by David Colacci. Directed by Bill Weideman. Engineered by Hunter Chapman. Performance copyright 1995 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.